This is Beverly Tomasi, and welcome to our Diabetes Boot Camp class number 3. This is a special class. We're going to be talking about insulin, insulin action, insulin patterns, how to recognize patterns, how to make adjustments in insulin. And it's a first half of a two-part series. So we'll be doing class 3 today and then class 4 in a few days. So it's too much material to cover in an hour and a half, and I really want to give this the material the time it needs. And so I'll just do the first half today, and then we'll wrap up the second half on Friday. So if you have any questions between now and Friday, you know, please let me know and I can address those. So let's get started. As always, we have a lot of exciting material to cover. If you haven't already, I would encourage you to get your diabetes, insulin, and injectables pocket card. Have that ready because we'll be referring to it during the presentation. And also, if you have the handouts available, that is a big help. And the handouts are on our online university site and also on your resource page. So as I mentioned, this is our third boot camp. It's the first half of Insulin and Pattern Management Boot Camp 4. It's on the second half. And the second half will focus on basal bolus and carb counting. But I did put both presentations on one handout. It just seemed like it was a natural flow to do it that way. So you'll see I'll only get to a certain point today, and then I'll wrap up with the second half later. I will say after the program to answer questions, the course will be recorded and available for viewing within 4 hours of completion of the session. It takes me some time to get things up and rolling. And then all you need to do is log in to the online university to hear the recorded version, take the quiz, and get your CEs, and you can email us or phone us if you're having any trouble. And on your resource page, as usual, I have a ton of articles for you to review. So you may say, do I need to read all of these for the exam? I don't know. I would be really familiar with at least the first four. Management of Hyperglycemia and Type 2 Diabetes. This is the American Diabetes Association update, and there's some really nice summary sheets I would print out and have available for yourself. This was the original article that this updated version was based on. I would be familiar with that. The AADE white paper on continuous subcutaneous insulin therapy, I would be familiar with that. There are questions on the exam on insulin pump. There's not a lot of them. But this paper really addresses some of the critical issues that you would need to be familiar with regarding insulin pump therapy. AADE strategies for insulin therapy, I would review that. It talks a lot about the science behind why we tell people to inject in certain locations, and it talks about absorption issues, so it has a lot of good information. The rest of this is more for your own reading information, diabetes medications on a budget. This is an article I wrote about how to make diabetes management affordable if patients don't have excellent insurance coverage. And here's some information about U500 and information on Afrezza. So that's more for your information, but the first one, two, three, four, I would be familiar with and know that for the exam. And so what are we going to be talking about today? Well, we're going to discuss the actions of different insulins and describe pattern management as an insulin adjustment tool. And as I've said many times, maybe you don't have prescriptive authority. Maybe you're not writing orders for insulin. But as diabetes educators, regardless of our profession, even if I'm a dietitian or a physical therapist, or we had a physical therapist in our class, it was so terrific, or maybe I am in social work, I should be familiar enough with insulin, what it does, and how to look at patterns to identify when patients at least need a change. And so some of us are more familiar with this content, some of us are less familiar. Everybody has their comfort zone. But at least we want to be able to know what insulin does when we're giving too much, when we're not giving enough, and how to make some adjustments, and how to bring it to the attention of providers that this insulin therapy situation is unsafe and we need to make some changes, or maybe it's just not getting the person to target. Here's a human proinsulin molecule. And so proinsulin is insulin stored in the pancreas. It's ready for action. So the pancreas is such a great organ. It's going to store proinsulin. And so that when blood sugars go up, your pancreas, as you know, is a glucose detective and a glucose sensor. As those blood sugars go up, the pancreas will actually break down this molecule into two separate parts. The C-peptide or connecting peptide chain, and here's the alpha and beta chain or the active insulin molecule. So you'll hear sometimes we'll say, let's measure C-peptide level. We're measuring the byproduct of insulin activation. We're measuring how much endogenous insulin a person makes when we measure C-peptide level. It has a longer half-life than insulin, and it's not confused with exogenous insulin injections. So it tells us how much endogenous or insulin that person is actually making. So here's a human proinsulin molecule. This connecting peptide is cleaved off. Here's the active alpha and beta chain. It goes into the liver, actually makes a first pass through the liver, and a lot of it, the insulin, about 40% is used initially in the liver, and then it enters the rest of the body to help bring blood sugars to target. I'd just like to tell you a little bit of the history of diabetes and the discovery of insulin. And this is Banting and Best, and Banting and Best were doing their work in the University of Toronto in the 1920s. And here's Dr. Banting. He actually had a dream about how to discover and how to help people living with diabetes and how to get them the solution to those high blood sugars. So what he imagined is if you could extract the pancreas of a dog or an animal and give them a total pancreatectomy and take the pancreas and grind it up and then gather whatever that pancreas is making and re-inject it into the dog who no longer has a pancreas, you could lower blood sugar levels. So that's what they were doing. They were giving these doggies total pancreatectomies, grinding up the pancreas, taking the solution from the pancreas, and injecting it. It was a hot summer. They did not have a sterile working situation. Many of the dogs died from infection. But Marjorie, in fact, lived. And what they did, they gave her, they could evaluate her blood sugar. So they saw her blood sugar was elevated above normal. She had no pancreas. They gave her insulin, and the blood sugars came down. Her blood sugars would go back up again after a few hours. They gave her more of the solution. They called insulin. Blood sugars came down. And so Marjorie, who lived for 70 days with these insulin injections, was the first proof, living proof, that if you don't have a pancreas but you take this hormone called insulin, you could live. This was a turning point for the discovery of insulin. And Banting and Best and Dr. Kollop were awarded the Nobel Prize for their discovery, and many mothers brought their little children up to Banting and Best in Toronto begging for some insulin. And so Eli Lilly got involved in the University of Toronto, going to the slaughterhouses and gathering beef and pork pancreases and grinding them up. Here's one mother who brought her little boy that we've met earlier in the first presentation up to Banting and Best, and he obviously has type 1 diabetes. He makes no insulin whatsoever, so he can't store fat for fuel. He can't store muscle. He is failure to thrive and severely dehydrated. They had these kids on 500 calorie a day diets just to sustain life. This mom brought her little boy up to Banting and Best, and she was able to get insulin for him. Here's Eli Lilly's insulin. Here's University of Toronto. University of Toronto finally gave up on production, and Eli Lilly took over, went to the slaughterhouses, gathered all those pancreases, and helped. At first, the first insulins were very dirty. They weren't a standard solution, and so over time, they had to fix that and improve that, which they did. They cleaned it up really nicely. But here's this little boy, December 15th, 1922. This is 2 months later, February 15th. After receiving insulin therapy, this is the same little boy. Doesn't he look a lot happier? Well, maybe he doesn't look a lot happier, but wow, he looks a lot healthier. So we're very excited that insulin is now available, and people flood it from all over the globe to get this miracle hormone. And when my patients with diabetes say, I don't want to go on insulin, I often think of this little boy, JL, and all the lives insulin has saved. And I try to reframe insulin for them. So let's just do our first poll question based on that. A patient tells you she doesn't want to start on insulin. What is your best response? Is it A, the needles are so small you won't feel a thing? Or is it B, you might die if you don't take insulin? Is it C, tell me why? Or is it D, well, there's a doctor's order to start insulin? So let's go ahead and launch that poll. Thanks for voting, everybody. I really appreciate it. Okay, you guys are on fire right now, I can tell. I'm going to have to ramp up these questions and make them more challenging. Okay, thanks for voting, everybody. And as I always say, if you don't get a question right, it's just information. It's feedback for you that, hey, I may want to study this area a little bit more. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share it with you. And so you all are right on. The first thing when people say, I don't want to do something in diabetes, like I don't want to check my blood sugar or I don't want to give injections, we just want to do exploration. Can you please tell me why? We want to hear their story. We want to know why they're pushing back against it. Because our patients have legitimate reasons for not wanting to go on insulin. We need to hear them, acknowledge them, and then help reduce the fear associated with that through a real honest dialogue. So a lot of what we do in diabetes education is we're honest and loving. Those two things put together so that the patient feels safe that they can share with us, but we also want to tell them the truth of what's happening with their diabetes so that they feel they're getting the complete story. But one of the reasons that many people with diabetes push against it is that they're threatened. 50% of providers in this one study by Dr. Rubin were threatened with a needle. If you don't get your blood sugars down, we're going to put you on insulin. And then many providers don't realize that insulin does have a really positive effect on type 2 diabetes. And a lot of patients don't think that insulin is going to help them improve their diabetes. Many times they think, well, Aunt Elizabeth went on insulin and she died, you know, within 3 months. Well, we know why, because we waited too long to put her on insulin, but they don't understand that. So we need to hear their story, acknowledge it, and then address it, looks like it says here. And the other thing it says on the bottom for solutions is use more insulin pens. And that brings me to my next slide. Insulin is a subcutaneous injection. Many times we use pens that are longer than needed. Here's the original insulin injection pen. You can see it's a half an inch. You don't need it that long to get into subcutaneous tissue. We can use short pens, the minis, the 5 millimeter, 8 millimeters, because we want to get into the fat, not the muscle. So we want to make sure we inject in places where we're not going too deep. And if the patient is really thin, they don't have much body fat, we're going to inject at an angle. But if they're heavier, like most of our type 2s are, we can inject straight in. So short needles, even 4 millimeters, no matter how overweight or obese a patient is, are effective. And that's based on some studies. Half the patients who could benefit from insulin are not using it due to needle phobia. We also want to consider inhaled insulin. And yes, we do have inhaled insulin available. We'll get to that in a minute. So we have options for our patients: short needles, insulin pens, inhaled insulin. Let's evaluate what they would feel most comfortable with. But before we keep going, let's take a look at the normal insulin function. And so you see here we have mealtime glucose and basal glucose. Mealtime glucose just reflects what happens to our blood sugar after a meal. And you can see this person is in a non-fed state. Here their blood sugar is pretty low, around 70. And they eat a meal and that blood sugar goes up to maybe 130, 140 at the most. It's probably right around 130. So we know they don't have diabetes. They don't even have prediabetes because a normal post-meal blood sugar is less than 140. And so this pancreas, if we look up here at the insulin secretion, is releasing enough insulin to cover that food bolus. And you can see the person had a smaller lunch, so their blood sugars just barely went up to 100, and the pancreas responded in kind. It didn't over-secrete, it just secreted enough to get those blood sugars to target. Dinner, again, is a little bit of a higher peak, but the pancreas responded in kind. And then look at what the pancreas does in between meals. It's releasing insulin, about 0.5 units an hour, to maintain basal glucose. Basal glucose is a glucose that comes from our liver in between meals and when we're not eating. So to keep this glucose from going too high, we need two types of insulin. And if you look at your green card right now, your insulin and injectables pocket card, you'll see if the person does not have a functional pancreas, we need to imitate the work of the pancreas. We do that through bolus insulins. That is, we take a shot of fast-acting, rapid-acting insulin with each meal to imitate what the pancreas does. Essentially, when we're doing insulin replacement therapy, we're trying to think, what would the pancreas do? We're doing insulin replacement therapy. That's what we're doing, hormone replacement therapy. Okay, And so you can imagine this person, for what they ate, probably needed, 4 to 5 units of bolus insulin to cover that. That's probably what their pancreas squirted out. That's a very common amount of insulin, because many times we need about 1 unit of insulin to cover 15 grams of carb. And let's just say most people eat 45 to 60 grams of carb per meal. So that's 3 to 4 units, general guesstimate of how much insulin a person needs per meal. But it's the bolus insulin, and that is, if you look on your card, aspart, lispro, glulysine, and regular. But in between meals and through the night, we need insulin to help regulate the basal glucose release from our liver. It's the basal insulin that does that. So basal insulin keeps the liver in check. Without basal insulin, the liver is on a party mode 24/7. It's just releasing all kinds of glucose. Basal insulin is very important. As I mentioned, your pancreas releases about 0.5 units an hour. But if you don't have a functional pancreas, we have to imitate what the pancreas should be doing through injections. So if you look at your green card, we have three basal insulins. We have NPH, we have D-dimer, and we have glargine. Those are the insulins that are available to help keep blood sugars in control between meals and through the night. So if we're going to think like a pancreas, we need to think, what would the pancreas do for this meal? What would the pancreas be doing in between meals and through the night? And can we imitate that with an injection? And so I consider these my insulin action teams. Bolus insulin is responsible for lowering after-meal glucose levels. We have our aspart, lispro, glulysine, and regular. We have Afrezza inhaled. And this is the rabbit. It's the rabbit of the insulin action team. But we also have a partner here, the slower guy called the turtle. The turtle's in no particular rush to get in. He's going to hang out for a half a day to a day and just wait till the job is done. This is our basal insulin. Basal controls between meals and through the night. We have an intermediate, and when that says intermediate, it means you need to take it twice a day. MPH only lasts max for about maybe 12 hours, so you need to take it. I know BID, where these other long-acting insulins are going to last for 20 to 24 hours. Now, if you look at your pocket card, you'll see I have the hours listed, onset, peak, duration. This is just based on the studies that they initially did for people on these insulins. They were doing the studies to see how they worked. But every patient absorbs insulin differently. We want to look at the individual, where they inject it, what activity they're doing, their body weight. I mean, there's so many factors that affect insulin utilization. So this is just a guideline. Your patient's going to absorb insulin in their own special way. Let's do another poll question. What best describes the role of bolus insulins? Is it A, to cover carbs at meals and hyperglycemia? Is it B, to help lower fasting glucose? Is it C, to keep overnight blood sugars under control? Or D, it should be used during hypoglycemic episodes? So what best describes bolus insulin, the role of bolus insulin? Okay, thanks for voting, everybody. I'm getting a really good feeling that all of you listening here are feeling pretty ready for this exam because you're answering with a lot of confidence these questions. You're just like, boom, I got this one. Okay, I'm going to close it and share with you. 100% of you guys got this right. It covers carbs at meal and covers hyperglycemia. So without any hesitation, you chose that. So I just want to say, on the exam, you want to look through all the questions. I'm sorry, you want to look through all the possible answers and get rid of any wrong answers first, and then let the right one bubble up. So sometimes the right one might be the first one. You're like, that's the right one. But please just take the time to read through all the questions to make sure there's not a better answer. Because on this exam, there are gradients of better. One might seem right, but you'll keep reading, and one might be a little bit more right. That's probably not good grammar, but that's the best way to describe it. Okay, great job, you guys. Bolus insulin should comprise half the total daily dose divided by meals. So you want to add up how much insulin your patients are on. So I had this patient come in, she's on 60 units of insulin a day. And so then in my mind, I'm thinking about half of that should be from bolus. If she's on 60, they should be on about 30 units of bolus divided by meals. And so you say, well, they should be on 30 units of bolus divided by 3 meals, which would be about 10 units each meal. You just want to make sure that the ratio bolus to basal is almost 50-50 because a lot of our patients are over basalized. We'll get to that later. They get so much basal and not enough bolus. So we want to make sure bolus is in there doing the job it's supposed to do. Bolus insulin, as you can see, starts working fast within 15 to 30 minutes and has a peak action of 1 to 1.5 hours. So this reminds me to say, tell patients we want to make sure they know when they give their insulin, they got to eat. So we want to associate injection with meals. And many times for my older patients who are at higher risk for hypoglycemia, I'm going to say do not inject your insulin until you see a meal in front of you. And so we kind of all adjust our education based on the patient and their risk. Regular insulin, onset 30 minutes. So we do encourage patients on regular insulin to try and delay eating by almost 30 minutes if they can. That's hard for a lot of people. So many times they just end up taking the insulin and then eating. So that's better than not taking it. But if they could just have a little lag time with a regular, it works better. And that's one of the reasons regular insulin is not used as much anymore. These newer insulins are used much more frequently. But as you know, regular insulin is a lot more affordable. We'll get to that later. Despite the valiant efforts of the research group, the insulin suppository still had one major problem. This will not be on the exam. The only reason I have this here is to say, you know what, we've been trying to figure out a different way to give insulin for a long time. We've tried all kinds of things, but we finally have now approved inhaled insulin. This was by Mankind Corporation. They did a lot of studies on it, and I believe it was purchased recently by a pharmaceutical company who's going to start distributing it ASAP, I'm hoping. This is called Afrezza. Now, Afrezza is regular insulin. It's regular old-fashioned insulin put into a powdered form so it can be inhaled. It's small enough to be absorbed by the alveoli. Here is Afrezza. This is 8 units. You can see when you inhale it, it gets in really quickly. And this is compared to insulin Lispro 8 units. They have, both have a similar onset, but you can see the Lispro hangs out a little bit longer. The half-life of the Afrezza is a little bit shorter. And so you both get the immediate lowering of the blood sugars, but the Afrezza leaves a little bit more quickly. It's utilized. This inhaled insulin was only studied in adults, so it's not indicated currently for those pregnant or breastfeeding or under the age of 18. But the FDA has said that they need to do ongoing studies for children. So it is approved. Now we need to market and distribute it. What they're thinking is it's going to cost about the same as insulin pens, $300 a month. It's powdered human insulin using Technosphere technology. So if you ever read about it in papers, it will be called T1. And I was wondering, what is T1? It's Technosphere insulin. That's the name they refer to it as in the studies. So just some considerations. Now you may ask me, is Afrezza going to be on the exam? Probably not, but it could be. It's FDA approved. It's an available therapy. So we just want to be familiar with it. And if our patients start asking us about it, you know, really important to have some knowledge, baseline knowledge about it. And I'm sure when it's released, we'll get a lot more information from, and we'll get to play with the device, you know, from the representatives. But Afrezza dosing and consideration, it's bolus regular insulin inhaled before each meal. So you still have to take it before each meal. You'll still need the basal insulin by injection. We have no basal inhaled insulin. It comes in 2 doses, 4 units and 8 units, and it's converted with a 1-to-1 ratio with existing insulin dose, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But it's based on units just like our injectable insulin is. We do need to do a lung function test before we start. This is inhaled in the alveoli, so it's not for patients with chronic lung issues, asthma, COPD, history of lung cancer, or smokers. And, you know, for patients at risk, it can cause bronchospasm, black box warning, so serious bronchospasm. We want to make sure that these patients have good lung function, so we do this forced expiratory volume, FEV1, before initiation. Side effects, the same as regular insulin with the addition of sore throat and cough, but it does cause less hypoglycemia than injected insulin. Here's the inhaler. You do not wash it. You just replace it every 15 days. So look how small this inhaler is. I don't know if you ever saw the Exubera inhaler, but it was a lot larger. So this is real advance in technology. They put a lot of time and energy into creating this easy-to-use device. So all you need to do is open it up, put the cartridge in. This is the insulin cartridge. Close it, and then it's ready for inhalation. I just wanted to say that the blue cartridges are 4 units, the green are 8 units, and you need to let you keep the insulin cartridges in the refrigerator, but when you're ready to use them, let them sit at room temperature for 10 minutes before using, and let the powder come to room temperature so it's more evenly absorbed into the VOI. So how do you use it? You hold the inhaler level, you open it up, you put the cartridge in, you close it, you exhale, and then position the inhaler in your mouth, and then you tilt it down towards your chin and take a inhalation as deeply and hold your breath for as long as comfortable and then breathe normally. That's it. So really easy to use. But the interesting thing, it only comes in 2 doses, 4 units or 8 units. So let's just take a look at that. What if I have a patient who's on 7 units of Humalog at meals and I want to put them on a Afrezza? I have 4 units or 8 units. What am I going to choose? I'm going to choose the 8 unit, but it's 1/1. What if the patient has type 1 diabetes? Maybe for that person with type 1, 8 units is just too much. They might get hypoglycemic. So maybe they have to eat a little bit extra to go along with that 8-unit inhalation. What if their before-meal blood glucose is 67? That might just be too much insulin for them. So they might have to bump it down to the 4-unit inhalation. And so I'm just kind of talking about this with you as you're working with patients with type 1 who want to go on a Afrezza to kind of do some problem solving around this and how would we do that. So in the studies, what a lot of the type 1s did, they would take an initial inhalation with the start of meals. They checked their blood sugar an hour later and see how it was going. And if they needed some more insulin, they would take it post-meal. What about type 2s though? You know, type 2s are a lot less insulin sensitive. So for a type 2 on 7 units of Humalog at meals, they could probably take the 8 units and not worry about hypoglycemia because they have a lot larger safety net because of insulin resistance. But what about if they carb count and they just ate 75 grams, you know, and they're supposed to take 5 units of insulin? Now what do? You have 4 or 8. And so patients on inhaled insulin are going to have to do some guesswork, and we're going to have to coach them around how to make the best decision regarding that. So just wanted to do a preview of things to come. So we have our bolus insulins, regular, Novolog, Humalog, Apedra, Afrezza. They start working fast, get out fast, and post-meal blood glucose reflects how effective they are. Half the total daily dose, and it covers food or hyperglycemia. And in general, as I've mentioned before, 1 unit of insulin covers 10 to 15 grams of carb. But we would just say generally 1 unit for every 15, unless we're doing more specific calculations. And then we also know that 1 unit lowers the blood sugar for a heavier patient, 30 points. For a lighter patient, maybe all the way up to 50 points. So this is called insulin sensitivity, and I'll be giving you a formula later on this to calculate. But we know that if I weigh, you know, 300 pounds, 1 unit might drop my blood sugars 30 points. But if a patient only weighs 100 pounds, they're much more insulin sensitive, and 1 unit might drop their blood sugar 50 points. So insulin sensitivity, insulin dosing is relative to body weight. That's a very, very important concept we'll talk a lot about. And I'll give you some formulas. But how is the effectiveness of bolus insulin determined? Well, we're going to do 2-hour post-meal blood sugar if you can get it. And if we use a 2-hour post-meal, we're going to look for a target of less than 180. Now, when I say if you can get it, it doesn't mean people with diabetes are lazy or, you know, or they are, I don't know, they're non-compliant. I'm not inferring that at all. What I mean is that it's hard to do that. For a lot of our patients on insulin, they're just going to check 4 times a day. And normally we rely on the before next meal blood sugar to see how well they responded. So for example, if I gave myself 10 units of Humalog before breakfast, I would look at my before lunch blood sugar to see how well that worked. If I gave myself, I will say that again, 10 units of Humalog before breakfast, I'm going to check on my pre-lunch blood sugar to see how well that worked. And this is going to be my target. If I took enough of that insulin, my blood sugar would be 80 to 130 before lunch. So we rely on the before next meal blood sugar a lot. For bedtime, we usually use the post-dinner blood sugar, which is less than 180. So we usually during the day use before next meal, and here's our target. And at bedtime, our target is less than 180. Let's do a poll question. Mary takes 4 units of Lystro before breakfast. What blood glucose result reflects that the dose was the right dose? Is it A, a before breakfast blood sugar of 97? Is it B, 1 hour post-breakfast blood sugar of 153? Is it C, before lunch blood sugar of 69? Or is it D, 2 hour post-meal blood sugar of 183? So let me go ahead and launch that poll for you all. And see what you come up with. And on the exam, they do usually list the generic and the trade names of the insulins and the oral medications. So they're pretty good about doing that. So you want to know what class these medications go in. That's really important. Okay. So it looks like 83% of you have voted. Do you want to take one more second to vote? Okay. Thanks, everyone. So let's go over this together because I think this is a really good learning one. So she took 4 units of Humalog before breakfast. What blood glucose reflects that it was the right dose? So nobody chose A, before breakfast blood glucose of 97, because that wouldn't reflect if she took the right dose. It doesn't even make sense, really. So that's just a weird answer. So we know that's wrong. B, 1 hour post-breakfast of 153. That looks really good to me because I know that after I took this insulin before breakfast, so if I checked a post-meal blood sugar 1 to 2 hours after, that number should be less than 180. So B looks like the right answer to me, but let me go to C. So C says before lunch blood sugar of 69. So my target for before lunch is 80 to 130. If I'm 69, that tells me I took too much insulin at breakfast. So that's the wrong answer. So if it's 69, that means I took too much insulin before breakfast. It's not the right dose for me. And 6% of you chose D, 2 hour post-breakfast of 183. 183 is close, but it's not right because it says 1 to 2 hours after a meal, less than 180. So 88% of you chose B. Great job, you guys. If you chose the other ones, it just says, hey, I just need to be a little bit more familiar with this type of question and the targets for blood sugars. So good job, you guys. Okay, let's keep going. Let's take a look at this picture. This is a slide I show pretty frequently in my presentations because I think it shows so dramatically why insulin sliding scale doesn't work. On this scale says, let's give this person insulin when their blood sugar reaches 150. So at 150, we give 2 units for every 50 above 150. So this says if I'm 150 to 200, I'll take 2 units. 200 to 250, I take 4, and so forth. I call it the 2-4-6-8 what don't we appreciate scale. And so this is a slide to show you how not to think like a pancreas. But if we can learn what is wrong, how to do it, you know, what is the wrong way to approach it, it helps us remember the right way. So let's just take a look at John. Let's put him, he could be inpatient or outpatient. I've seen this situation occur. I've been doing this almost, you know, over 20 years. I've seen it happen a lot of times in the inpatient, outpatient setting, at all settings. So his breakfast blood sugar is 94. According to his sliding scale, he takes no insulin because insulin starts at 150. Now, John is going to eat 45 grams of carbohydrate. If he's going to eat 45 grams of carbohydrate, how much insulin would he need to cover that? Well, he takes about 1 for every 15. Let's just say generally humans in general need about 1 for every 15. So if he needs 1 unit for every 15 grams of carb to cover that, he should have taken 3 units of insulin. But because his blood sugars were on target, he took none. And so we don't even need to look at the slide any further to know he's going to go high at lunch. And sure enough, he's above target at lunch. What's our target for before lunch? Exactly, 80 to 130. He's 212, above target. So 212, you know, now what are we going to do? Well, the scale calls for 4 units, and the R stands for regular. 4 units of regular. Is that enough insulin? Well, let's think about it. He's going to eat 45 grams for lunch, which would be 3 units, so 1 unit for every 15 grams of carb, plus an additional unit for hyperglycemia. So just by luck, it's almost right. But this patient also is like, my blood sugars are high. I'm going to cut back on my carbs. He got 4 units of regular. Okay, great. Dinner is looking improved. It's not on target yet. The target for before dinner is 80 to 130. We're at 148. We're not there, but we're moving in the right direction. But guess what? Since his blood sugar is less than 150, no insulin. So no insulin at 150. He's hungry. He's like, I've been really trying to carb restrict today. I'm just hungry. So he eats, 60 grams of carb. 60 grams of carb, no insulin given. What's going to happen to his blood sugar? It's going to go high. See, this is not thinking like a pancreas. Normally, the pancreas would squirt out enough insulin to cover the food. And so if you don't have a functional pancreas, we need to imitate that through injections. And sliding scale does not imitate the work of the pancreas. It starts too late. It starts at 150. If this scale started at 80, it would be a lot better. But it starts too late. Okay. We received no insulin. You know what's going to happen at bedtime. Blood sugar is 254. So the goal for bedtime, as we mentioned, it's a 2-hour post-meal. It should be less than 180. It's not that. It's 254. And so I do want to tell you on the bedtime blood sugar, I do have an upper limit. If people are on insulin, I like it 110 to 180 because I don't want them going to bed too low. 110 to 180 is kind of the sweet spot. But anyways, he's 254. So the scale calls for 6 units of regular. This is not a good strategy. Anytime a patient comes in to see me and they're taking bolus insulin at bedtime, it's one of the first things we stop. It's so dangerous because it's not designed to be given at bedtime. It's designed to be given with meals. So just imagine, he ate 60 grams of carb. If we would have given 4 units here at dinner, his nighttime blood sugar would have been right on target. It would have been great. But now we're giving it too late. 6 units of regular. So that's going to start working in a half hour, peak in 2 to 4 hours. So right in the middle of the night, 2 a.m., this insulin work is working at its hardest. 2 a.m. And that 2 to 4 a.m. is the highest risk for hypoglycemia, by the way. So let's take a look at his morning. Oh, my gosh. He woke up at 2:43. So what does that tell you? That tells you two things. One, there's two possibilities. One is that he got really low blood sugar in the middle of the night, and that is from that regular insulin, right around 4 a.m., his blood sugar went down to 50s, maybe 60s. So he released adrenaline and all those stress hormones to try and crank up his blood sugars. And the fancy word for that is the SEMOGI effect, SEMOGI, or rebound hyperglycemia. Or maybe it's too high because what insulin is he missing if we're thinking like a pancreas? Basal insulin. There's no basal on board. It's all bolus insulin. So it could be one of two things. And we're going to ask this patient, hey, last night did you notice you had some weird dreams? Did you wake up with a headache? Did you wake up sweaty? Did you wake up hungry? All signs of nocturnal hypoglycemia. And if he says yes, then we know he got low in the middle of the night. And maybe he tells us, well, I don't really know. I just slept through it all. So that doesn't really help us. But generally, we know that this is not a good place to start our day. So we are going to move this regular to dinner. Really, I rarely give bolus insulin at bedtime. If the bedtime blood sugar is high, we have to fix something at dinner. We need some basal insulin here. And let's just look through the rest of the day. He's 243, 4 units. And then he's still elevated at lunch. Anyways, you can look through this whole situation, and you might want to look later and see how many times did this patient get their blood sugar to target on this regimen. And you can take a look and see if there's any that are on target. And the other thing I want to say to you is how many times a day is this patient checking the blood sugar? 4 times a day. How many times a day are they giving insulin? 3 to 4 times a day. With this amount of work, they should have excellent blood sugar control. Their blood sugar should be on target 80% of the time. 80%. They are never on target except for one here at breakfast, 94. And you can imagine, as adult learners, we would be like, why should I keep doing this? This is not working. I keep, checking my blood sugars and giving insulin. They're never on target. So you can imagine this patient giving up, and they might be called non-compliant. They're not non-compliant. The plan isn't working. They're frustrated. And so as educators, this is what we do. We come in, we look at these patterns, we identify this is not working, and depending on our comfort level, we're going to contact the provider and suggest change. I mean, at the very least, we would call the doc and say, you know what, doc, I'm really concerned. This patient's checking their blood sugars 4 times a day using the sliding scale, and their blood sugars are never on target, and the patient's really discouraged. Or if we feel more comfortable, we can suggest a solution, which I'll talk about in a minute. Okay, and so now we have basal insulin. So we've talked about bolus, and we're going to talk about basal, and then we'll do some formulas. So basal insulin should be half of the total daily dose. We have intermediate acting like MPH, which lasts for about peak action is 4 to 12 hours, and it lasts for about a half a day. That's why we give it twice a day. You can see here the duration says up to 24 hours. So there's some remnants, you know, that just hang around for a while, especially if they have kidney failure. But really, the active part of this MPH is for up to about 12 hours. Now you can see Dedamir, Glargine, and Glargine 2-HEO, all are long-acting basal insulins. They're peakless, and they last for 24 hours. This 2-HEO is just newly released. It's concentrated insulin glargine. So it's what I would call a U300, or there's 300 units in a mil. So it's 3 times as concentrated as the Lantus. It's just coming out right now. The FDA approved it. I just want to let you know it's out there. I'm not going to talk about it during this presentation, but you might start seeing it in your setting wherever you work. I doubt that it will be on the exam, but just to know it's available. This 2-HEO is in an insulin pen. So the FDA has said if you're going to do concentrated insulins, it's so confusing and potentially dangerous, you need to provide a device that goes along with it. So that's the good news. As far as basal insulins, how do we tell how well they're working? The fasting blood glucose reflects the efficacy of basal. So if we want to see if we're getting enough basal, we look at fasting. And sometimes in hospital settings, you'll see that patients wake up and their morning blood sugars are low. They're, you know, 60s or 50s, and they're on 20 units of Lantus at night. If they're on 20 units of Lantus at night and they're waking up with low fasting, so we've got to reduce the Lantus. If we don't reduce the Lantus, they're going to keep waking up with lows. So basal insulin is reflected in fasting blood sugar. If the fasting blood sugar is too low, it's too much basal. If the fasting blood sugar is high, not enough basal. Okay, so basal insulin summary. It covers between meals through the night. It's the turtle. It's going to hang out for half a day to a day. And so let's do some patterns to kind of put this into management. And I call this, you know, how to think like a pancreas. How are we going to think like a pancreas to help our patients get blood sugars to target? And so I want to ask you a poll question. When looking at glucose patterns, which problem do you fix first? Is it A, hyperglycemia, B, hypo, C, noncompliance, or D, legible writing? Oh, I haven't launched it yet. Sorry about that. I have a feeling you guys are just going to, you know, rock this one too. All right. Thanks for voting, everybody. Okay. I'm going to close this and share it with you. So let's just look at the first one. When looking at glucose patterns, which problem do you fix first? And this is a really important concept for the exam, but also just for our practice. And so 6% of you said, let's fix hyperglycemia first. Well, it is important to fix hyperglycemia, but it's not our first priority because hyperglycemia is important. But more important is B, hypoglycemia, because if the patient is running, having hypoglycemia, they can perish. They can get into severe situations with low blood sugar. So of the two, low blood sugar is the most pressing, is the most important thing to fix first. So, but let's keep going. So hyperglycemia is important, but hypoglycemia is more important. And that's a lot of this exam too. You look through all the answers and figure out what is the best answer, what is more important. That's going to come up a lot during the exam. Is it C, noncompliance? No, we don't, this is, I'm really glad I put that in there. That was one of my juicy answers. But we don't really talk about noncompliance in the context of diabetes management and diabetes education. We really want to work on the empowerment model and moving our patients toward self-care. And so when we talk noncompliance, that means they're not obeying our orders. And really, when we think about diabetes self-management, it's really about a partnership with the person. So C is the wrong answer, and nobody chose D. But look at this, 88% of you chose the right answer, B. We want to fix hypoglycemia first. Great job, everybody. So let's keep going. So pattern management in safety first. We want to evaluate three-day patterns. So when we're looking at blood sugars, it's not just the day. We want at least 3 days if we can get it. Evaluate and fix hypoglycemia first. And I love this note. If possible, decrease medication dose. We always want to get to the least amount of medication possible to control blood sugars. We never want to over-medicate somebody with diabetes. That can lead to hypoglycemia. And if they're getting a lot of hypoglycemia, they're going to eat more to treat the hypo. And then if they eat more to treat the hypo, they gain weight. It's not a good situation. So we always want to keep them on the least amount of medication possible to get the job done. Then we evaluate and fix hyperglycemia, making sure they're taking their insulin, there's not a missing dose, and seeing, you know, what their intake is like. Let's take a look at this gentleman. He's type 2, BMI is 32, new diagnosis, no medications. What patterns do you see? What recommendations and what medications do you think he would benefit from? So this gentleman on no medications. What patterns? Okay, well, I said let's look for hypo first. Now, I just want to tell you, in this situation, it doesn't really apply because he's on no medication. So he's not really at risk for low blood sugar, but I'm going to look and see when does he have the lowest of the day, and that's at dinner. So what does that tell me about lunch? That tells me that he's probably eating a pretty light lunch, maybe not eating too many carbs, maybe he's very active at between lunch and dinner. And even his lunch blood sugars are pretty fantastic considering they were higher at breakfast. And so we see this a lot. We see people with type 2 diabetes with morning hyperglycemia, no fault of their own, because now let's move on, sorry, to hyperglycemia. He's running above target at breakfast. The target's 80 to 130. And at bedtime, he's above target with a blood sugar target of less than 180. But let me just stick to breakfast for a second. And so when I see this, when a patient walks into my office, I'm really thinking one thing, and I'm thinking liver. The liver is releasing a bunch of sugar at night because you're not making enough insulin to keep the liver in check. Insulin throughout the night keeps the liver from releasing all of its glycogen stores. Fasting hyperglycemia is usually a result of liver hyper release of glucose. So how do we fix that? Well, let's go to bedtime. And so we could say, you know what, your morning blood sugars are above target, and I see that your nighttime blood sugars are above target too. So we're going to take a look at that dinner meal. You know, maybe we can look at your carbohydrate intake at dinner, and here's all the carbs you're eating at dinner. Could you cut back on any of these? Would that be comfortable for you? Or we could say, would you be willing to go for a walk after dinner? You know, we know that walking 10 minutes after meals can substantially lower your blood sugars. And by the way, you're doing such a great job of checking your blood sugars. Let's see on the days that you walk after dinner if your blood sugars aren't lower. So we're going to use his desire to get blood sugars to target to help motivate, you know, support his own motivation. We can't motivate anybody, but we're going to say looking at your blood sugars in relation to what you eat and your activity can really incentivize you to make these changes and reinforce the changes you do make. But anyways, I would say that we're going to, you know, make sure he's eating healthily and active. But when I see this, many times I think this patient is really ready for some medication. Maybe some metformin would be in order. So, of course, we're always looking at, you know, exercise and diet. But let's say we've tried that, and now his morning blood sugars are still above target. So metformin would be a really great match for him because it would help lower that morning blood sugar, and metformin is particularly good at keeping the liver under control. So I would definitely, in addition to activity and lifestyle, consider metformin therapy. Let's take a look. I just want to say Sally asked a really good question. She says, what if a patient's newly diagnosed with type 2 and they're on no medications and they're able to maintain their blood sugars through activity and eating healthfully? Is that okay? Absolutely. The American Diabetes Association, and we'll go over this next week, does talk about if a patient is newly diagnosed with type 2, but they're able to get their blood sugars to target through lifestyle change, stick with it. It's only when their blood sugars start going above target that we do consider adding medication in. And as I always do, I'll stay after class and answer any additional questions too. So we'll just kind of see how the conversation flows today, and I'll answer as many questions as I can live. And then if not, we can always do after class questions. Let's take a look at this guy. He's on glyburide 10 milligrams in the morning. And if you look at your oral medication pocket cards, if you have those available, glyburide falls into the class of sulfonylurea. And it's 10 milligrams, and you just might want to know for the exam and in general, what's the max dose of these meds? Because 10 milligrams is an important number. It tells me he's on half the maximum dose. He's not on the full dose yet. So that gives me information. He's on half the maximum dose, and he's also on Detemir, 12 units. Now, what is Detemir? So I'm going to just remember, what is Detemir? You can look at your green card while we're together here. It's a basal insulin. He's on 12 units at night. So now let's take a look so we have a good understanding of his medications, what they do. He's on a sulfonylurea, and he's on a basal insulin. Let's take a look at where do you see the blood sugars most problematic throughout this 24-hour period. Okay. I just want to get back to our last case study for a second. Somebody said if they wake up high in the morning, that can it help to take a bedtime snack? Some patients actually do respond well to that, that if they wake up high in the morning, they haven't eaten for like 12 hours, a lot of people, and that can really stimulate the liver to release its glucose stores. So sometimes having a 15-gram snack before you go to bed, 15-gram carb snack, can help calm down the liver a little bit. But it also could lead to weight gain. You know what I mean? So it's this fine line we're walking. So we could consider that though. Okay. So let me get back to this person. So where are you all worried about the blood sugars? We're worried about dinner. The target for before dinner is 80 to 130. They made this one time. But here the blood sugar is 43. Very dangerous, entering into neuroglycopenia. We don't like that at all. So what is the culprit here? Is it the glyburide, the sulfonylurea, or is it the Detemir, the basal insulin? You're right. It is the glyburide. The glyburide is potent enough that it's causing this dinner blood sugar to go down. How do I know it's not the Detemir? Detemir was given at night. It lasts for up to 24 hours. So by dinner time, it's waxing and waning. Its half-life it doesn't have much oomph left. So I know the culprit is glyburide. So now, as a diabetes educator, I have to take action. If I don't take action, this patient could have a severe, profound hypoglycemic event. And I'm going to call the provider, and I'm going to say, dear doctor, patient's having low blood sugars at dinner. Can we reduce the glyburide to 5 milligrams? Absolutely. Cut it in half. And actually, I do want to tell you, and I'll put this in your resource page, that there's a new study that came out that sulfonylureas plus insulin are really not the best strategy because they do tend to increase risk of severe hypoglycemia and mortality. And so an even better switchover might be to stop the glyburide and put them on some metformin. That would be, to me, the best choice. But I always start, you know, conservative, and depending on the provider and my relationship, I'll say, you know, can we cut this in half? That would be better than doing nothing, so that's good. Or I'm really concerned about hypoglycemia. Could we stop the glyburide and switch her to metformin, which would be a safer combination? So that would be the best suggestion in my mind. Okay, so we fixed dinner, and then you might say, well, now what do you do? Well, we fix dinner and we let things calm down. We want to see what happens. And now we fix the hypo. We want to fix the hyper. But I might give that a week before I do any more additional changes. But the next thing that really stands out to me is bedtime. Bedtime's above target. But I'm really thinking it's above target because at dinner, she was so hungry. She had low blood sugar at dinner, so she was overeating to get those blood sugars up, and that's why bedtime is so high. So I think that's going to improve as we decrease the glyburide, but I am going to look at this morning blood sugar. Morning blood sugar target is 80 to 130. So it seems pretty clear to me that we're going to need to increase this Denimer. Maybe not now, but you know, we're considering it in the future because we want that morning blood sugar less than 130. And how much would you increase it? Generally, they say about 10%. So we'd go up, you know, it's 10 to 20% increase. But I'm always more conservative than I am generous because I want to see what's the least amount they need to get their blood sugars to target. So we might go up to 13 or 14, depending on that patient's home situation and their safety. Okay, so we've helped that situation. Let's go on to our next one. Poll question number 5. Oh, I answered the question already. Sorry, but based on the case study, what would be the first action you would suggest to the provider? And then we said to reduce the glyburide dose. And that was the right answer. Okay. So basal plus metformin. Let's look at this guy. He's on basal insulin, so that means he's on this Lantus, and he's on metformin. He's type 2, he weighs 80 kilograms, and his A1C is 8.7. And so this is a situation I see a lot in real life. Here's the morning blood sugars, and we know the target is less than 130. And so the morning blood sugars initially started out at 170s, so the provider said, let's get him on some Lantus in addition to his metformin. So we started at 10 units, and he saw that wasn't enough. Increase him to 20. Now he's on 40 units of Lantus, and his morning blood sugars are a little bit still above target. And the other thing they noticed is the A1C was up. So the provider asked the patient, start checking your daytime blood sugars. We were just getting the morning blood sugars, and so now he said, let's check before lunch and dinner. And holy mackerel, here's the answer. So just like that one situation where we just used bolus insulin and we weren't getting to target, now we're just using basal insulin and we're not getting to target. We're getting that morning down, but the during the day blood sugars are above target. Now look at this patient. I mean, this is really not him. It's a clip art I got, but this is how our patients look discouraged. I'm doing everything they ask. I'm taking my basal insulin. I'm taking my metformin. I'm trying to exercise and I'm still running high. It's not their fault. It's that the plan doesn't match them. And so here's a really great algorithm, and I put this in your handout. It's, you know, very small letters in your handout because I just, you know, fit it into a PowerPoint slide. But in your resources under the ADA guidelines, I have it a full page handout on this. But this is really such a great algorithm, and I'm using it in my practice a lot, and it's really helping me to inform patients and providers of the next steps. This is from the American Diabetes Association. This is for people approach to starting and adjusting insulin in type 2. This is not for type 1s. This is for type 2s. Okay, this is very important. So what they say is if you're going to put somebody on insulin, they should really be on metformin. And we add to metformin the basal insulin. Why? Type 2s have insulin resistance, so you want to have them on metformin to decrease insulin resistance. And then the metformin, you add on basal insulin, those two are a really great combination. But what insulin do we start at, basal insulin? And here it says start at 10 units a day, or you could use body weight, 0.1 to 0.2 units of basal insulin per kilogram per day. But a general getting started place is about 10 units. If they're really lean and older, we may say 5. If they're heavier, we might start a little bit higher, but 10 is the safest place. And then look at this. Adjust 10 to 15% or 2 to 4 units once or twice weekly to achieve fasting blood glucose target. So not every day, once or twice weekly. Very conservative incremental increases. But this is very important. If there's hypoglycemia, and this is morning hypoglycemia, determine and address the cause. Reduce the dose by 4 units or 10 to 20%. I like the 4 unit drop. I think that's a really great place to go. Just drop it 4 units and see how much they really need, if they're having any morning blood sugars less than 70. Okay, very important box. But now look at this. If the blood sugars are not controlled after fasting blood glucose target is reached, or if dose is more than 0.5 units per kilogram per day, treat PPG, means postprandial glucose excursions, with mealtime insulin. This is such an important triangle. This is new. It wasn't in the 2012 version, so I think it really helps us a lot. If we've got the fasting blood sugar down, this guy's on 40 units of basal, for example, but now he has these postprandial glucose excursions, we need to add mealtime insulin. But this is a really important number they give us. If dose is more than 0.5 units per kilogram per day. So let's go look at him. So if the dose of basal is more than 0.5 units per kilogram per day, and the blood sugars are still elevated, we need to take action. Let's just calculate that out. He's 80 kilograms. What's 80 times 0.5? 40 units. So if he's on 40 units of basal a day and the blood sugars are still not at target, we need to take action. He is at 40 units a day. We could keep increasing this Lantus. We might get the blood sugar in the morning down to 130, but we would not help these daytime blood sugars. So this is a really great algorithm to help inform us of our next steps. How much basal is too much basal is really what the question it answers. But let's keep going over to the left. It says, add one rapid injection before largest meal. That's one thing we could do. And it says start at 4 units or 0.1 unit per kilogram or 10% of basal dose. This guy is on 40 units of basal. What's 10% of that? 4 units. So 4 units is a very common number we see to start people out with bolus insulin at the largest meal. So we're going to ask them, what is your largest meal? And then you can see you adjust the dose by 1 to 2 units once to twice a week. But look what else we could do. Change to premixed insulin twice daily. So you would take the current basal dose, 40 units, and give 2/3 in the morning and 1/3 in the PM, or you could do half and half. Either way. But this is very interesting that we could now think about putting him on a pre-mixed insulin. So let's keep moving forward with him, and you can keep reading through this, but this is a very helpful chart to get us started. And here I highlight this. When is it too much basal? Just because of my practice, I see a lot of patients come in on 100 units of basal and there's no bolus on board. So this gives us a number to use to calculate, are they on more than they need, and should we be taking a different approach? So next steps. He's at the max basal dose. We've already talked about that, 40 units. And I said, don't add sulfonylurea. So that's not the thing we want to do, because we know that if we want to get his blood sugars down, he's on metformin and he's on basal. What's the next step? We don't really want to add sulfonylurea to that situation. We want to consider start bolus insulin at largest meal, or switch to 70-30. That's what it told us. So let's just take a look at what is a 70-30 insulin. 70-30 insulin is 70% basal and 30% bolus. This first number, 75-25, is 75% basal, 25% bolus. 50-50 is 50% basal, 50% bolus. So it just represents the percentage of basal versus bolus. It's a premixed insulin, and the benefit of this is that you get the onset pretty immediately after injection, within, you know, a half an hour, and then you get a peak 1 to 4 hours after. So, and it lasts for about 16 hours, or it lasts, I would just say generally, is about a half a day. So you get the onset, and you get a peak, and you get, it stops around a half a day. So you have to take this insulin twice a day, before breakfast and before dinner. But the great thing about it is it has a basal plus a bolus. So for patients who are just overwhelmed, their blood sugars are 300, you just want to get them into the 200s, you could initiate this 70-30 or 50-50 or 75-25 therapy, and it's easy for the patients to do. But I do have the caveat here. It's difficult to fine-tune therapy because you're just on this standard regimen. So for our patients, once they get their blood sugars down, we might want to move them on to more intensive insulin therapy. Okay, so let's just see how we would do this. We want to switch him to from 40 units of basal to 70-30 insulin. So what we do is we take the total current dose, 40 units, and divide it. Two-thirds in the morning, one-third in the PM. So two-thirds of basal in the morning would be, I just changed it to a decimal point, about 0.6. So he's on 40 units times 0.6 means he would get 24 units of 70-30 in the morning. And then one-third unit, I just made it 0.4 for easy math. So 40 units, which is his initial dose, times 0.4 would be the other 16. So he'd get 24 units in the morning of 70-30 and 16 before dinner. That's how you calculate it out. And let's just say we did this. We put this patient on 24 70-30 in the morning and 16 units of 70-30 in the PM. What patterns do you see that are making you worried? What are you particularly worried about with him? Okay, we're worried about lunch. His pre-lunch blood sugar is below target. The target is 80 to 130. He never makes that. So what insulin do we have to change? Exactly. We have to change the 24 units of 70-30 in the morning. This is 70% basal, 30% bolus. So that bolus insulin that's part of that 70-30 is making the lunch blood sugar go too low. So what do we decrease it by? Well, we said 4 units or 10, you know, to 20%. So I would just say, let's just go down 4 units. Let's say 20 units of 70-30 in the morning. That will help our lunch blood sugar be safe, and I think our dinner will be just fine with that decrease because, again, people, when they have lows, tend to overeat. And so we're going to decrease the 70-30 in the morning to 20 units. We fix that. Now, what we let that sit for a week or so. What's our next thing we're worried about? Well, what about his bedtime blood sugar? His bedtime blood sugar target is less than 180. Is he making that? Well, he's close. He has a 181, a 195, a 201, and a 211. So how are we going to fix that? So you could say to me, well, Bev, let's increase to 70-30 at dinner because that 30% of bolus doesn't look like enough to get his bedtime down. But we have to remember there's 70% basal, and that 70% basal that we give at dinner time is going to affect morning blood sugar. How is morning blood sugar coming in? It's 100% on target. The target's 80 to 130. We do not want to mess with the morning blood sugar. So I would say I would not increase the 70-30 before dinner. I would not increase it. I'm too worried about hypoglycemia in the morning. And now I have a good talking point with the patient. I'm going to go, you know what? Your blood sugar at bedtime, the target's 180. You're just a little bit above that. I think if you do what? It'll come down. Yeah, if you go for a walk after dinner. I bet you if you walk for 15 minutes after dinner, we can get that bedtime blood sugar to target. Let's experiment and find out. Or we could approach it from a carbohydrate perspective and say, you know what? If you reduced your carbs at dinner, let's see what would happen to your blood sugar. I bet you if you reduce his carbs at dinner by even 10 grams, it would help his morning blood sugar. I didn't mean to say that. If you reduce his dinner carbs by about 10 grams, his bedtime blood sugar would come down a little bit. We don't know how much. So this is part of engaging the patient, empowering the patient, helping the patient move towards self-management, using that glucose meter and the results as a tool to help him succeed. And so in this case study, we're going to reduce to 70-30 to 20 units, and we're going to coach him through getting his bedtime blood sugar to target. If we can't get it through lifestyle changes, we'll go to plan B. But for right now, we're going to work on lifestyle. And so again, just to reiterate a key point, you always want to have patients on the least amount of insulin necessary to get blood sugars to target. Let's look at this guy. He's 70 years old. He weighs 100 kilograms. History of CABG, and it's a coronary artery bypass. Tobacco, his A1C is way above target. Blood sugars, wow. Insulin, 100 units of Lantus plus Solostar. I mean, it's a Lantus Solostar pen injector. His oral meds are metformin and Invokana. And the patient tells you, I can't afford Lantus insulin pens or Invokana. My doctor just gave me some samples, but after that runs out, I can't afford any of it. So what I would like you to do is go to this little poll and ask you, which insulins are cheapest? If a patient tells you this, I can't afford this stuff, what insulins would you direct him toward? Is it A, Lantus and Levemir? Is it B, Novolog and Humalog? Is it C, regular and MPH? Or is it D, insulin pens? Okay. Thanks, you guys, for voting. I'm going to share this with you. And 100% of you got the right answer. Regular and NPH are the least expensive. And I do have to share with you, because I have a lot of patients in this situation where they can't afford their insulins, or in the donut hole, or they have their copay is so big, that I did some phone calling and I found out that Walmart has the cheapest insulins out there, regular NPH and 7030 for $25 a bottle. This is Novolin insulin, they rechanged the label to rely on insulin for Walmart. And so these insulins are least expensive for our patients. These other insulins, you know, I just want to say regular and NPH insulin can get the job done. They're a little trickier to use for our patients, but if cost is an issue, it's something we definitely want to consider. But of course, patients can also appeal directly to the pharmaceutical companies to see if they will give them a discounted rate. So that's another strategy we can use. So the main point is we want to make sure our patients can afford their medications, because if they can't afford it, they're not going to take it. Let's go back to our case study, though. And this patient weighs 100 kilograms. So based on the formula that we learned, that how much would be the max basal insulin he should be on? What do you all think? Let's take a look. It says the max basal dose, when the dose exceeds 0.5 units of insulin per kilogram per day, we should move on to another strategy to get blood sugars to goal. So he weighs 100 kilograms, that's over 200 pounds. Once his basal insulin is about 50 units a day, we need to take a next step to figure out how can we better manage these blood sugars. And obviously, I'm sure you all thinking about this too, this guy needs some bolus insulin. So what could we do to improve that blood glucose? And this is based on that ADA algorithm. We could add 4 units of bolus to his largest meal. So we could find out, when is your biggest meal? Let's add 4 units of bolus. I could tell you that's not going to be enough. We could also do 10% of his basal dose. So you could say, well, he needs 50 of basal. Let's start him on 5 units per meal. That could be a starting place. But we need to do something to help get those blood sugars down. We could switch him to 70-30, insulin before breakfast and dinner. Based on his previous dose of 100 units, we could give two-thirds in the morning, which would be 65 units. Or we could do and one-third before dinner, 35 units. That might be another way of doing it too. So how do we figure out which strategy we use? It's based on the insurance coverage. It's based on the patient's willingness. So this comes back to the empowerment method. And looking at the adult and figuring out, where are their needs, values, and concerns? Can he stick to a complex regimen, or do we need to keep it really simple? How well can he self-monitor? And then look at this, his social support and his connection to his medical team. All of these come into play when we're trying to figure out the best solution for this particular patient. But let's just do a quick calculation. A lot of times as diabetes educators, we help write prescriptions for medications, or we, you know, make sure the patient has enough insulin available. Let's take a look at this patient. They take 30 units of Humalog at breakfast and dinner. They take 20 units of Humalog at lunch and in between breakfast and lunch. If blood glucose is over 200, here's their A1C. My question to you is, how many vials of insulin would this person need a month? And I want to tell you something very important. There's 1,000 units in a vial of insulin. So, here's the question. This person takes 30 units of lispro twice a day, 20 units BID as needed. How many vials would Sarah need a month? Let me launch the poll. Is it 1 to 2 vials a month? Is it 2 to 3 vials a month? Is it 3 vials a month? Or is it D, 2 vials a month? So you might have to pull out a pad and a paper and do some quick mathematical calculations to figure out the right answer. And the main thing I told you that's really important to know is that in one vial of insulin, there's 1,000 units. And on the exam, they have asked questions in this vein before, giving you how much insulin a person takes a day, and then you have to calculate out how many vials they'd use a month or how much insulin they'd use a month or something like that. But you're going to just need to be able to, you know, figure this out. Okay, great. Thanks, everybody, for voting. I appreciate it. So this person takes 30 units twice a day. So I wrote this down here. There's 1,000 units per vial. Sarah takes up to 100 units a day. So she takes 60 twice a day and 20 twice a day as needed. But we just have to assume she's going to need this 20 additional units twice a day to make sure she has enough. So that's 30 plus 30 is 60 plus an additional 20 plus 20 is 40. So she uses 100 units a day. What I said is she takes up to 100 units a day. There's 1,000 units per vial. So one vial lasts 10 days. 10 days times 100 units equals 1,000 units. So for her, she's going to need 3 vials per month. And you know what? Let me share your results. And 70% of you got that right. So that's a pretty hard one. And if you didn't get it right, just plug in different numbers and experiment so you have a chance to do the math again. And I'll try and add some other additional poll questions. I'm asking this type of questions. But you have to know that you have to assume in this situation she would take the full dose every day. So what would she need to cover her insulin needs? How many vials per month? And it's 3. Okay, thanks everybody for voting. I appreciate it. So our approach depends on the patient. How much insulin we're going to give them. And you can see here, as I was talking about, insulin sensitivity is really relative to body weight. And if our patients walk through the door and they're a little on the heavier side, they're going to definitely need more insulin. And if they're on the leaner side, their insulin needs are decreased. This person here on the left is not very insulin sensitive. They're probably pretty insulin resistant. This gentleman on the right is probably very sensitive to insulin. So he's not going to need 10 units of Humalog per meal. He's probably going to need 3 to 4 units of Humalog per meal. This gentleman, on the other hand, you know, will need a lot more bolus and basal to cover his insulin needs. So here's another poll question. How much insulin does a patient with type 2 diabetes need a day? Is it about 1 unit per pound per day? Is it no more than 0.5 units per kilogram per day? Is it approximately 5 units per kilogram per day? Or is it about 0.5 to 1 units per kilogram per day? Okay. This is so interesting. So I'm looking at my poll questions, and I don't see this in there. Oh, I just found it. So let me go ahead and launch that and see what you think is the right answer. So even if you don't know the right answer for this one, get rid of wrong answers first. Get rid of ones that seem just like doesn't make sense. Okay, good job. Thank you for voting, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and close the poll. And I did put a juicy answer in here for you. So let me share the results. So nobody chose about 1 unit per pound per day because you could do a quick calculation. If I weigh 200 pounds, that means I need 200 units. That just doesn't seem right at all. But B was the juicy answer I was trying to kind of lure you into. And with a type 2 diabetes, we would be skeptical to think they need no more than 0.5 units of insulin per kilogram per day because insulin needs vary so much on the patient, and actually 0.5 units is a really low dose for most type 2s. They generally need a little bit more. But even if I didn't know that, I would be skeptical to say the cutoff is at 0.5 because we know with each individual the insulin needs vary so much. So B is not the right answer. Nobody chose C. That's really excellent. I just left off a decimal point. But D is the right answer. And you know what? When I think about this, 81% of you chose this. It makes sense why this is the right answer because you see the word about, approximately. That is more conducive to being the right answer, especially when we're looking at individualizing for patients. So this is the right answer, about 0.5 to 1 units of insulin per kilogram per day. So 80% of you chose that. Great job, everybody. Let's keep going. Here's a nice little chart. This looks at insulin needs based on type of diabetes. Now, this is just, bell curves. Where did most people land? And for type 1 diabetes, they're more insulin sensitive. They're not insulin resistant. So all we have to do is replace the insulin they don't make. We don't have to overcome resistance. So type 1, if you look on the bell curve, need about, 0.5 units, maybe 1 unit per insulin per day at the most. So they need less. But look at our type 2s. You can see they kind of start at 0.6 and then they go all the way to 2 units of insulin per kilogram per day. I mean, there's outliers certainly. But our type 2s, because they're insulin deficient plus resistant, need a lot more insulin. So they're, one notch over on the scale, and they need their bell curve is a standard deviation to the right here. So they need more insulin. And then we have others that are much more insulin resistant. But I bring this up because we're going to talk for a few minutes about our patients who have very high insulin needs. If they need more than 200 units a day, how do we manage that? And there is an insulin out there that's been out around for a while, but Eli Lilly has just dusted it off recently. It's U500. So it's 5 times the concentration of U100 regular insulin. U500 comes in a different packaging. It comes in a red and a white box with stripes. The U500 is large and in red, and it says concentrated. And Eli Lilly has been selling a lot more of this lately because so many of our patients with type 2 diabetes are obese. And the heavier our population gets, the more insulin they need. Here's regular insulin. Here's U500 regular insulin. This has 10 milliliters. This has 20 milliliters of insulin in one bottle. So U500 insulin, we consider it if the patient's on more than 200 units a day. It's regular insulin, but it's concentrated. It's 5 times the concentration of U100 regular insulin. I'm going to say that in a different way. It means in 1 milliliter of U500, there's 500 units. In 1 milliliter of U100, there's 100 units. So U500 is 500 units per milliliter versus U100, which is 100 units per milliliter. So it's 5 times the concentration. I'm trying to make this more clear, and I hope I'm achieving that goal. So how much insulin? When you're converting from U100 to U500, well, you take the total daily dose and divide by 5. For example, if I take normally 200 units of insulin a day, and I'm going to go to U500, I say 200 units divided by 5, because U500 is 5 times the concentration, I only need now 40 units a day of U500. If I'm on 300 units a day and I switch over to U500, I divide that times 5, I only need 60 units a day. So you can see just psychologically from going from 300 units a day of insulin to 60 units a day, how much easier that is on patients because the volume is a lot less. So if you're on 300 units a day, that means you have to pull up U100 syringes, the 1cc U100 syringes, a complete full 100 units of insulin 3 times a day. If I'm on U500, I just need 60 units a day. There's 20 milliliters in a vial. There's 500 units per mil in U500. That means there's 10,000 units per vial. When I first did this slide, it was $400 cost per vial. Now it's up to $1,200 per vial. As the market has been driving this and more people are getting it, the cost has gone up. So is it still less expensive unit for unit? It used to be. I don't know if that's still the truth with this increased cost. But we definitely want to consider this for our patients who are on very high levels of insulin. Oh, somebody's saying, shoot, they're not seeing my, hang on one sec. Can you see my screen now? Is that better? Sometimes these things have a mind of their own, these PowerPoint presentations and all that stuff. Okay. Can anybody, just if you could say yes, the show is, you can see the show. Can you say yes or is it still no? Okay, good. You can see it. Thanks, Jennifer. Okay, let's keep going then. Okay. So U500, you can take the total daily needs of insulin and split it into 2 to 3 doses. U500 has the quality of both basal and bolus. So once you get on U500, you need no other insulin. That's really important. So you just take your total insulin dose, divide it by 5. That's how much U500 you need. And then if you're going to take 2 doses of U500, you get 60% in the morning and 40% in the PM. Or if you divide it into 3 doses, this is the ratio you divide it into. So this, as you can imagine, has its consequence as far as making sure people know how to do it safely. So many times they'll use a U100 syringe. If I'm on 25 units, then I only need 5 units on a U100 syringe of U500. But a lot of times we're using tuberculin syringes. We use tuberculin syringes to deliver U500 because it's a volume-based delivery then, and we think there's less error. So I just want to leave this with you. This is a chart you can take a look at. But if a patient does come in on U500, we need to proceed with caution, and many times pharmacy will draw that up if they're in the hospital setting. But we need to make a big stink about it on our medical records, so patients, so the staff knows that they're on U500, a concentrated insulin. Okay, so it's 12:57. What I'm going to do is introduce this case study, and then when we kick it off again on Friday, we'll pick up where we've left off. But I just want to introduce this case study, and so we can get a look at this. So this patient, we are going to just take a look at his insulin. And insulin dose is H, which stands for Humalog. 7 of Humalog at breakfast, 5 of Humalog at lunch, 8 at dinner, and 22 of Datamir at bedtime. That's his standard dose. So let's take a look and see what his blood sugars are doing. And we look for patterns. And the first pattern we're always looking for is hypoglycemia. So where do you see the hypoglycemia risk right now? Exactly. Before breakfast. So before breakfast, the target is 80 to 130. He made that one time. So what insulin is at fault here? It's the basal. So the basal is the Datamir. So we would say, okay, too much Datamir at night, morning blood sugars are less than 80, and we remember our formula, we're going to reduce it by 4 units or 20%. So let's go down. 4 units, 20% would be 4.4, so we could reduce it more if we worried about this patient. But for sure, 20 units would be number one thing I would do. Okay, so we fixed the Datamir. The morning blood sugars will come up now. Let's take a look at lunch. Is lunch on target? Yeah, and it's going to be even a little bit higher now that we fixed the morning, because the morning was so low. So lunch was looking pretty good, but what about dinner? Dinner's above target consistently. And so the question I'm going to say to you now is, where did the patient get this insulin regimen? 7 of H, 5 of H, 8 of H. He never adjusts it. He never varies it. It's always the same every day. And I'm going to tell you where he got it from. I asked him, I go, John, where did you get this insulin regimen from? He's like, well, I made it up myself. And I'm like, okay, tell me about that. Well, I saw an endocrinologist 20 years back, and he got me on insulin. And then I moved. I didn't see him anymore. So I just adjusted my own insulin. And so I tell him, I appreciate that you're really trying hard to get your blood sugars to target, because this guy is really doing a lot of work. He's checking his blood sugars 4 times a day. He's writing it down. He's taking insulin 4 times a day. He should have excellent blood sugars, but he hasn't got enough coaching and support to succeed. So what we'll do on Friday and then in session 2 of this program is we'll start where this patient's at, and we'll see what formula can we use to help get his blood sugars closer to target. So we made it through most of where we needed to get to today. We'll pick up on this second half of this on the pattern management special webcast, and we'll do some more calculations and problem solving. So I'll be hanging out after I press the stop recording button to answer any additional questions. But for right now, I'll be signing off, and we'll see you at our next boot camp. Thank you so much. This is Beverly Tomasian signing off.